The Tom Woods Show, episode 2231.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Come on now, folks. If you ain't going to start that side hustle now, then when? Check out my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income, where I take you step by step through five things that I do that keep food on the Woods household table and how you can do them too. Check it out at pathstoincome.com. Hey, folks, Tom Woods here. We have our old friend Jeff Deist here on the program, of course, president of the Mises Institute. And Jeff just gave a talk in Prague that I thought might be of some interest to you folks. We'll talk about that a bit. But first, Jeff, what was the event that you spoke at? Like, who sponsored it? What was the idea behind it?
Well, it's interesting. I have been following in the periphery this idea of private cities and private governance and some of the various models which people have tried to put into effect for several years now. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of Liberland and Wittgenstein. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of the Free State Project up in New Hampshire. A lot of your listeners may have heard of the Prospera Project, which is down in an island off of Honduras. It's called a ZA, which is the Spanish acronym for a Zone of Economic Development, which was something that was constitutionally created under the Honduran Constitution. And I'm good friends with Joel Baumgar and Trey Goff. Joel is a state rep in Mississippi. Trey works for him sort of as a chief of staff. And they have some other people involved in that project down in Honduras. So I've been following that. It took a little bit of an unpleasant turn when the new Honduran president was elected last year. And she's the wife of a former Honduran president and is pretty hostile to the ZA concept and sort of views it as these outsider white Bitcoin tech bros, you know, are going to come into Honduras and do what they want. So there's a little bit of tension there, but they're proceeding apace. And then, of course, a friend of mine, a gentleman named Titus Gebel, who is, I believe, originally from Germany, perhaps Switzerland, but he wrote a great book called Free Private Cities, which is really fascinating and is behind the organization called Free Private Cities. He's also with the Seasteading Institute, which is an organization dedicated to building these communities offshore, you know, beyond territorial waters of any particular government. Patrick Friedman, who is the grandson of Milton Friedman. He's either the son or the nephew, I'm not sure, of David Friedman. So he's been involved with that, also with Tita. So I've been sort of on the periphery of all of this. I was a little surprised when they asked me to speak simply because, you know, a lot of their movement surrounds itself with the idea of being an expatriate or a digital nomad, you know, someone who lives, you know, outside of their country of birth or whatever, and that the Mises Institute is a little bit more on the theoretical end, the Rothbardian end of things. But nonetheless, Titus asked me to speak. And so in prepping for the talk, I went back and reread portions of Ed Stringham's great book, Private Governance. It's really a beautifully done, I believe it's Oxford Press, but it's just a fantastic little book.
It's a great book. I've had both of them on the show. They're both great.
And it really goes into a lot of the history of court systems, for example. I made this point in Prague. You know, we may not realize it, but back in Adam Smith's time, you know, just a, I don't want to say peasant, but just an average Scotsman or Englishman could avail himself of several different courts. In the event of a dispute, there were common law courts and chancery courts and local manorial courts. And, you know, there was a choice of law to an English peasant a couple of centuries ago that we don't have in the United States today. So basically, Titus asked me to speak. And when I went over there, I realized on day one, and I made a trip to Prague out of it and not so bad, but I realized on day one, it was definitely the thrust of the conference was in more, I guess what we could loosely say is a left libertarian direction, which is all about sort of a self-actualization, emancipation. I mentioned the idea of being a digital nomad, you know, this idea that we all need to be loosed of any constraints, including national or political ones. And that's not my worldview. And so I came at it very differently. I said, look, we can talk about parallel structures. And that's great because parallel is not a scary word like private. Parallel means coexisting peacefully. It means if you like your government, you can keep it. People who have no objection whatsoever to, let's say, the private governance of the Roman Catholic Church or the British Historical Trust, the biggest landowner in the UK, or, you know, the Dallas Cowboys, or Google or Twitter. People have no problem with the idea of these organizations having private internal governance, owning vast amounts of land, owning real estate, having lots of money, a bigger GDP and or bigger revenue than a lot of countries' GDP. But somehow when you start talking about privatizing even their local police or something, people flip out. They just have this really negative reaction to privatization of government services because that conjures up for them some sort of corporatist dystopia. So I like the idea of parallel structures. I thought that was a great theme. But so many of the speakers were sort of talking about escaping. It had an escapist quality to it. Though, you know, we need to build something new. We need to find these intentional communities. And so my talk centered around the idea that, hey, look, these communities already exist everywhere. We just have to identify them and coalesce around them because these large, sclerotic Western welfare states, as we all well know, are going to break up of their own accord. They're not sustainable. You know, either the United States with its military empire or the EU with its terrible euro currency or the entitlement and pension problems in a place like Italy or Greece. I mean, these are just intractable problems for which there are no ready solutions. Not to mention here in the United States, by the way, we have a what they call the fiscal gap, an entitlement gap of something like $200 trillion with a T between what we're likely to bring in taxes over the next 30 to 50 years and what we're likely to owe old people who would very much like to get Medicare and Social Security in those same 30 to 50 years. So we know that these structures, these political entities under which we're forced to live in the West are not long for the world. So what are some of the communities which already exist? You know, and this idea that we have to move away and go live on an island or in a pod 11 miles off the ocean or all these things, it's like, well, I think what we ought to be talking about is more of a commercial enterprise. You know, how do we sell people better neighborhoods, cleaner, safer streets, better policing? How do we talk to soccer moms? How do we talk to old people, you know, retirees? What can we learn from communities like the Amish and the Mennonites in portions of the U.S. Midwest? In other words, what sort of communities and models already exist that could sort of become the axis for a new private, hopefully, or semi-private system after some sort of dissolution of these big Western states? And number two, beyond just identifying or coalescing around these existing nations within a nation, that's a term I like, Rothbard used it, nation as opposed to state. There's also, you know, what would be the mechanisms for governing? How would we handle property rights? How would we handle violence? How would we handle disputes? All the things that we think of that the government has to provide for us. Well, it turns out we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of common law mechanisms which are available to us already. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We don't have to write a brand new constitution. We don't have to have a strange or foreign or scary new set of laws. A lot of what we think of as the grease that makes a good or happy society possible has already been figured out by human beings over many centuries of tough trial and error. And of course, the beauty of common law mechanisms, and Ed Stringham goes into this in his book, is that they can be very, very exacting in terms of the particular geography and circumstances of a newly created community, the temporal elements of it. You know, what's happening in the world now, stealing a man's horse a few hundred years ago versus stealing a man's horse today might require a different punishment. And so questions of proportionality, you know, all of these things can be handled using just old common law concepts. And we don't need a legislature. We don't need a centralized legislative body or a centralized government to do this. We can basically do this voluntarily, which is to say privately. So to sum it all up, I tried to make my talk much more realistic, to say, let's make this model. We're trying to figure out how to create new private societies. Let's make the model fit the market rather than trying to force the market to come to us and, you know, go live in Honduras or something. And I'm not criticizing that project whatsoever. Again, I love Joel Baumgar and I think what they're doing down there is great, but I don't think it has mass appeal. And so in keeping with sort of my worldview, the Rothbardian outlook, I tried to give a talk that was more real politic, I guess, for lack of a better term, because private still sounds scary to people. But all of these sort of natural communities, I think people can look at that and sort of nod and say, yes, you know, we could potentially govern ourselves.
All right. So I liked it a lot because I've been, of course, wrestling with and thinking about these ideas for a long time. And you have the immense talent of making my crazy ideas sound reasonable. Sometimes I can do that. Occasionally, I can make my ideas sound reasonable and not scary to the general public. But yet there is a sense in which the way you put it is, in fact, for some reason, scary to certain types of libertarians. I mean, what was your sense of the reaction to your talk?
Well, the first thing is this was a mostly European audience. The European Students for Liberty organization was there, represented with a booth and some others. And I would say, generally speaking, at least I don't like the term social issues, but I would say, if we're going to use that issue, I would say that European libertarians tend to be a little more left of American libertarians, tend to be less focused on just property and markets and the blocking and tackling stuff, but more on this sort of loftier ideas of liberty in our lifetimes. And that was really the theme of the conference is, hey, look, we're all struggling under these governments. They're murderous. They have their endless wars. You know, we've got NATO now. We have currencies which are just absolutely degrading us. We have divisiveness caused, I mean, look at this ridiculous midterm we've got coming up. You know, and we all want out from under this. And we want that sooner rather than later. We don't want that 100 years off. So, but it might be 100 years off. So that's challenge number one is, do you have the willingness to try to move towards something that you may not enjoy in your lifetime? And you can apply that to any number of things, building a business, putting some money away for your family, planting trees, all kinds of things that might not manifest until you're gone. And number two, while I watched some of the younger people in the audience squirm uneasily in their chairs, I said, well, you know, the oldest and most enduring form of private governance is the family. Because that's pretty much just private and you get to do what you want. And, you know, the best thing you can do, or maybe the fastest thing you can do, is have some kids. So be sure you're, as you're thinking about seasteading or becoming a perpetual traveler or a digital nomad or working in the Bitcoin space or whatever it might be, and you're going to all these conferences, don't forget, you know, to meet someone and have kids along the way. So that was definitely, I think that helped me to stand out.
Wildly controversial. Maybe you should think about having kids. Maybe there's more to this than just my personal satisfaction.
You know, it's like I just have this 3-ton right-wing elephant that I just drag around with me everywhere I go, Tom.
but honestly, that right-wing elephant gets less right-wing in a sense, in that the things we say that are supposed to be controversial were just such obvious commonplaces until recently, that it's unbelievable what actually gets people irritated here. Now, you know, there are two different sorts of groups we have to deal with if we're trying to spread the ideas that you were trying to spread in that talk. And one is the normie, non-ideological person. And that person, I almost feel like I'm not really aiming at right now because there's too much to bring them up to speed on. You don't start with somebody by saying, well, we can resolve our disputes without a monopolistic court system. And no one, you know, a normie is not even going to be able to compute that at all. I can spread that idea to somebody who is a, quote, let's say, limited government person, because I can get them to understand that if they're going to be consistent with what they already believe, well, they should think about this because probably they just haven't before, you know? And then, maybe they might. And that's generally what I've succeeded in doing. So on the one hand, we have the normies, who I think, as I say, in fact, if I even argue with a normie and they want to ask me how would the roads be handled or courts or whatever, what I generally say is, how about we'll stipulate for the sake of argument that the government will provide the courts and the roads, okay? Now let's just talk about all the other things. And if I can convince them on the other things, then they will see the light on the roads and the courts someday. But I see it as a huge, huge rhetorical mistake on the part of libertarians to start with the toughest arguments of all. Now, you were able to get away with it because you were talking to an audience of people who presumably shared at least, you know, some of your first principles about avoiding monopoly, avoiding coercion. So having said all that, Would you say that the people at this conference generally were ANCAPs, like full on, or were they, are they looking basically to build little minarchist societies here or there with governments that have new and better constitutions that'll work this time?
I would say they were generally anarchists. I would say they were, it was a younger crowd. I would say it's an impatient crowd. There's nothing wrong with that. These are people who feel like perhaps we've done theory and debate and influence to death, and it's time to go out there and build. So I admire that.
There is something to that.
Right. Absolutely. I like the term commercial. I mean, again, people don't bat an eye at vast corporations controlling all kinds of things privately and having internal governance. Now, sure, if you work at Google and in Google building in this vast, you know, Google has billions and billions of dollars and, you know, tons of real estate and all kinds of people. And you could say that that's sort of a little community or an intentional community or almost a form of private governance unto itself. Now, obviously, I understand if you shoot someone into Google building, then the outside state or federal or local laws are going to apply and this and that. But nonetheless, I mean, you can go a long way with, I think, a commercial model and just say, look, you know, we're trying to sell you things. And to sell you things, we have to market and we have to, you know, have some sort of an entrepreneurial discovery of what you actually want. And it has to be win-win and all kinds of things. So I think that approaching it more as an entrepreneurial or business matter rather than a political matter is the way to go. All kinds of people use private services of many stripes that they, you know, that they could theoretically get from government. I mean, lots of people go to private doctors, even in countries with socialized medicine, for example. Lots of people use private toll roads. Lots of people pay extra to live in some sort of gated community or have some sort of private security. I mean, there's, I view this exercise as expanding those types of things and chipping away at those types of things rather than a more radical or utopian approach. But that's also because I'm in my 50s. I mean, these younger kids, God bless them. I mean, let them be radical and utopian in their approach because, you know, maybe the harder they push, the faster this will happen. But I do think there's lots of nations out there already. I don't think we need to go to an island somewhere and somehow attract a libertarian nation. I think most nations, truth be told, wouldn't be very libertarian. And are we willing to accept that? I certainly am. Who am I to say how another area organizes itself? And I do think that the United States is going to lapse, not by design, but by default, into a series of what Hoppe has this great term called implicitly seceded territories. And we've already seen that to an extent. If the Trump administration says, well, we're going to have some sort of immigration ban. No Muslims, you know, no Muslims from these 7 or 10 countries are allowed to enter the United States. And, you know, Gavin Newsom in California says, no, you know, we're not going to do that. We're not going to enforce that. We're going to ignore that or tie it up in court or whatever we do. I mean, that's just a small example of what I think is going to grow much, much bigger and larger. And if you notice, during COVID, which presumably was a great opportunity for the most centralizing organizations, not just in DC and the CDC and HHS and, you know, the American organizations that attempt to be the bosses of so-called public health, but even on the world scale, the WHO, the UN, I mean, they all pretty much failed to project authority, single authority worldwide. And so countries lapsed into their own COVID policies, which were more, you know, geographically appropriate. And within the U.S., we saw a variety of COVID policies. We saw some pretty defiant governors, and we saw some governors who were, in my opinion, criminals in that they have no legal authority to do what they did. There's no public health exception for the federal or their own state constitutions, and they ought to be in jail. And a lot of governors in between somewhere. So that's interesting to me that we had such a real world, real time example of what I'm hoping is this sort of future breakup. And it may not be as neat and tidy as we wish it to be. But, you know, maybe these private city initiatives, maybe these seasteading initiatives, maybe they can be out there leading, you know, providing a workable example. But I do think that trying to get hundreds of thousands or millions of people to move and uproot is less attractive than trying to identify, you know, what's a nation at this point in the United States? I mean, we could identify probably six or seven very easily. And within those, there's not going to be perfection. There's not going to be widespread agreement on everything. There's going to be folks with all different interests. But I mean, you could loosely certainly identify nations like SEC Nation, you know, Bucky's Nation. You could certainly identify Cascadia, you know, Seattle and Portland. You could certainly identify the Mountain West. I mean, you know, where it's an overlap of cultural, political, social, you know, geography, all these things that determine what kind of rules you have to live under rather than one size fits all from DC. So I think it's happening and I love to see it. I think it's happening much too slowly for our friends who were at this conference.
Well, I kind of feel both things here, right? As I kind of depart that phase of my life in which I could be called young, and I enter that phase in which the best people can say about me is I'm not that old. That's what I've started getting more. Oh, you're not that old. I'm getting that more and more. So I feel both. I feel the pull of both things. I want immediate results and I want hard-headed practicality. I think there is a way to combine those things, of course, but I'm reminded of in the 19th century, there were various utopian communities set up, so-called intentional communities in the North. And the idea was, some of them would be socialist communities. And the idea was that we'll set up this community and everybody will see how great it is not to have private property, and other people will want to imitate us and establish their own communities along these lines. Well, as you might imagine, none of these communities lasted even 2 years. They all fell apart, so they couldn't last long enough to be much of an example to anybody. But also, the principles on which these communities were based were not designed to be of general appeal. I mean, abolishing private property is not really of general appeal, or abolishing monogamous marriage, as was done in the John Henry Noyes community. Gosh, what was, or Humphrey Noyes? Oh, the Oneida community, right? They eventually started producing flatware. Well, they had a community where there was no marriage. The 19th century reformist mind believed that you could have a perfect society if you could simply get rid of various obstacles that were in man's path. So that would be alcohol, ignorance, private property, rivalrousness because, you know, I have a prettier wife than you do kind of thing. And if we could just get these things out of the way, we would be off to the races. We don't view it that way. We don't say if we could get the state out of the way, we'll have utopia. I just want a place that's livable and where I don't feel like I'm at war with all of society 24 hours a day. That's a much simpler ask than what these 19th century utopians were asking for.
Well, of course, and there's no reason that we need to have communes or to have societies that don't comport with human nature. I mean, we all know the story of Bernie Sanders. You know, he wouldn't wash the dishes and he was a bad roommate and he couldn't even succeed at that. And so what we have in the real world every day is market entrepreneurs waking up and trying to figure out ways to satisfy us and get our money. I think that's the way to look at this, is this is about services. This is about selling people services. And hopefully, as you do this, diminishing their appetite from these so-called services from the state. So, you know, private security. Take Disneyland as an example. I mean, yes, there's an entry fee, but within Disneyland, the Disney security has every incentive not to escalate, not to cause scenes. It's the happiest place on earth. If someone's shoplifting, they try to deal with that very, very quietly. They don't want to go out there and club the guy because, unlike the Anaheim Police Department, they could be sued civilly if they club the guy potentially. So there's all kinds of reasons that, you know, Disney, with its entry fees and with its rules, they don't want people getting too drunk, you know, all kinds of things, you know, has a bit of an oasis feel. You don't have to imagine a utopia. You just have to imagine the market, because the market is a utopia compared to 30 years ago. I mean, if you consider a modern smartphone versus a flip phone of, I guess, the 80s or something, you know, were they flip phones then? I don't know. That's almost unthinkable, right? So we don't have to design this stuff. It can happen on its own if we just sort of expand the marketplace. And the best book here, I mean, along with Ed Stringham's book, is Hans Adam II in Liechtenstein. He wrote his book, governance in the third millennium. And it's just an absolutely fantastic book. He lays out a very pragmatic case. It's not pie in the sky stuff. You know, he understands political reality. He's definitely not an anarchist. He understands European history and war and territories and property and all kinds of stubborn attachments that people have, language, et cetera. But basically he says, look, you know, we have evolved as human beings from a system of feudalism and then monarchs, you know, into 20th century democracy, despite all of its imperfections, and that the next evolution for human society is basically what we could call private governance, which is that governments stop viewing themselves as rulers of subjects and start viewing themselves as competitive service providers. And they do that because we sort of force them to do that. But it's a really fascinating read. And, you know, again, he's not a pie in the sky guy. So I like the idea of viewing this as an entrepreneurial for-profit task rather than, you know, either a utopian vision where we all have to go off into the woods or to an island somewhere, or that we need to change the human nature of millions of people to get them to go along with our program. I mean, if you have to force people to do something against their nature, then obviously that's not a market approach.
Right. Well, I will say that one very helpful precursor to getting people to think radically differently about something is to have them feel as if the established authorities can't be trusted on anything, that they've probably been lied to, not just about current events, but also about history, that they can't trust any of the mainstream channels, and that all the sorts of things they've been warned against as being bad and terrible, they start to wonder, huh, maybe they're not so bad and terrible. Maybe the things we're encouraged to look into are the bad and terrible things. And that's been done for us by the establishment over the past few years, even just the past few years, is they have made people willing to rethink all kinds of things. I mean, I bet there are people now who they didn't like the COVID jab. I bet there are people because of that who have said, I wonder if any of the vaccines out there are okay. You know, that's surely that's happened. Mm-hmm. So I think you now have a lot of people with more open minds than ever because they do not trust the establishment and they are willing to think outside the box because they know that inside the box, that's where hell is.
Yeah, it's so true. Maybe this is what it takes. It takes a government that has devolved to a point where not only can it not provide the things it says it can provide, like entitlements and welfare and roads without potholes and a decent dollar that doesn't inflate too much and, you know, peace in the Middle East and all these other things that it can't produce, but that people just come to a realization that this thing isn't working. I mean, let's face it. If we had a government, let's say federal government, which was even somewhat reasonable, if we had a federal government that just, you know, had pretty sound gold-backed dollar, you know, yeah, maybe they engage in inflation sometimes, you know, when there's a big budget deficit or something. And we basically had, let's say, the foreign policy of a Dwight Eisenhower. And let's say that most people still believed that you should have to work. You shouldn't just get welfare or disability without working unless you, you know, you really are disabled or something like that. And that the overall tax burden was 10 or 15%. And this was all sold to us as, hey, look, we can't have people who can't care for themselves out on the street like beggars. This isn't Calcutta. You know, we can't have old little old ladies thrown out of their homes at age 90 because they run out of, you know what I mean? Just, you know, we all got to pay in 10 or 15% of our income. Come on. Now, if that were the reality in the West, we'd probably grumble a little bit and we might say, oh, this new mayor, you know, he didn't fix the, you know, it took him 6 months to fix that freeway overpass and it made me late for work. You know, we'd be sort of grumbling. We wouldn't have this existential daily crisis where we literally feel like there's this gigantic mafia that would imprison us or kill us if we don't go along with the program. I mean, you know, it's pretty amazing to think about it, that just the level of how jaundiced we are relative to our own government versus, let's say, our grandparents when Eisenhower was president. It's pretty remarkable. It's a pretty huge shift in just a couple generations.
Well, our friend Hunt Tooley was saying not too long ago that he really is convinced that up until the Kennedy assassination, basically everybody believed what the government told them in the U.S. And you can easily see that in the laid-back 1950s with the moderate Dwight Eisenhower, who seemed like a pretty trustworthy figure. They trusted it until that moment when some of them started to think, well, wait a minute, in this case, we're not being told the right thing. Now, today, you have half the country not believing it at any given time. At any given time, no matter, so Democrat or Republican, at any given time, half the country doesn't believe it. That's very, I mean, that's an incredible cultural shift in one person's lifetime.
It is. It's an incredible shift. And
it's an opportunity.
It's an opportunity. I mean, some days I still wake up and I'm still shocked by the degree of openness we have in the online world. I mean, some days I wake up and I think, I can't believe they still sort of let this happen on Twitter or otherwise. But here we are.
Yes, indeed. Well, I assume, is there any news coming out of the Mises Institute these days? You've just had the supporter summit a few weeks ago, which I attended.
Indeed. And we are expanding our graduate program. Our master's degree program is going full guns. And we are sort of drafting all off of that to build a very, what we're going to call a truly quick and dirty executive MBA, an Austrian MBA, an alt MBA. So we are going to be offering an MBA without any fluff, let's just say. You won't be taking any DEI classes in our MBA. You'll just be learning some decidedly different Austrian ways of looking at the world. And look, there's all these MBAs out there right now, and most of them are executive. They're these weekend things. And so a lot of the big schools are playing off their names, like a Harvard MBA, a Harvard executive MBA, because all kinds of people who can't get into Harvard can nonetheless just pay, or more likely their employer pays. And then they go to this Harvard weekend thing and they get Harvard on their resume. And so, but a lot of these programs, you know, they're just rehashed old content. The profs are just teaching the same old concepts about business. There's actually some very radical Austrian thinking going on about how to view business and entrepreneurship using Austrian economics as business training versus a lot of what's taught in MBA programs, which is either wrong, in many cases, or actively harmful. So we're excited about that. We're excited about bringing the world an Austrian MBA.
That is really, really great news. So we will, I'll send a note out to my list when it launches, and I'm sure there'll be some interest in those quarters. So let's see, I'm going to link to, you mentioned a few books. I want to link people to those. So I'll put them on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2231. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, folks, that is another episode of the Tom Woods Show. I will see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.